One, two, three, four, five.
Oh, yes, from the part where they went both in both directions.
Yes. I was saying that they came to this point where they were to go in different directions, and they began to argue again. But they decided we'd better not argue now, because it's about time for that lion to be coming. And they came to the conclusion that what we'll do is to split this kudu wide open, halfway down, and one will take one half and the other will take the other. When the lion came to this point, he smelled that some of the kudu had gone in each direction, so he couldn't decide which way to go. And there he had his paws stretched out, this paw dug in the ground trying to pull him that way, and this one trying to pull him that way, and he pulled so hard that he split himself wide open, and the two natives had that kudu. One had one half and the other had the other, and they were saved. And the moral of that is that you must not stop to argue over something when somebody else is apt to take the whole thing away from you both. Yes.
You spoke about this plantation that was bought by the Freedmen's Bureau.
Yes.
And then plots were sold to the Freedmen. Did they establish a school there?
They established a school. The Freedmen's Society established schools all over the South. Now, the Methodists and Presbyterians perhaps did the finest pieces of missionary work among Negroes of any of the denominations. So this school, they always established a school. And that was what I should have brought out. They had this school. The way they built the school was just like they built the cabins. And they'd get teachers. The teachers weren't well educated, but there was no pay for them. They would teach as best they could. Reggie managed to get through far enough to go away to college. It didn't mean college at all, because the colleges down there, most of them had elementary schools. I was born in Greenville, but we moved to Atlanta right away, so I have never gone to a public school. I went to the university school at Clark College, because at that time, sixth grade was the highest that they had for Negroes in the entire state. And those schools were so poor that parents who could afford it just didn't send their children there. They'd send them to the college primary schools. So now, this school came up and the students kept going. And by the time that Reggie was finishing college, they needed a teacher. And the old judge told him that he thought he ought to come back and teach, and the white people of the town were willing to build a school. And the minister told him that there is a rich Jew in Chicago who will give us the money if we'll just support the school once we get it. They said, well, we'd like to have a Rosenwald school, but who would teach it? Then they decided they wanted Reggie, and they went to Swamp Angel. Reggie had been to New York. He wanted to come to New York to study law. And Swamp Angel was talking to him about it. And that's where some of Swamp Angel's old cornfield philosophy came out. He was talking with him one night. He said, Reggie, you see, if you take this school and you want to change, then you can go study your law and you have more money to do it. Say, but right now, the white people here will support you. Say, you know, you better take it now while they will support you. Because white people are like beef gravy. It's mighty good, but you'll have to eat it while it's hot.
Well, I can agree with Swamp Rachel right there.
Which means, if you don't take it now, the white people may withdraw their offer and we're lost. So that, after he came back and looked over it, he decided that he would take the school, and he did. And they built the school. One of the churches gave them a bell even. And instead of one teacher, they had three teachers, and at that time, that was an advanced school. And he starts out with this school, and that school system has become a very fine system, and I have a niece that teaches there right now in Greenville, Georgia. Mrs. Eveline McLaughlin, who Janice has met. She teaches right there in that school.
Do you remember any more of Swamp Angel's expressions or sayings?
Well, yes, I want to tell this. When Reggie graduated, Swamp Angel and his mother and Reggie's mother were invited to come up to Atlanta to see him graduate. They were invited to the commencement. They wondered, how on earth could you say commencement? He commenced 7 years ago. But they went. And when they got there, they were escorted up to the front and sat among the guests as parents who had children to graduate. And they had been told not to look back. Of course, Swamp Angel had been to so many conferences, church conferences and everything. It was something ordinary with him. But Reggie's mother had never seen this. And she kept looking back, people standing at the door. And pretty soon, they had the procession. And when they had the procession, the faculty came in front. And when it was all over, the students, the graduates, went out without the faculty. And when she got back home, everybody came over to the house for them to tell them about this commencement. You know, they had a way of dropping certain syllables. Say, I want you to tell me about this commencement and how come you call it a commencement? And they said, well, I'll tell you about the commencement. Said, they told me not to look back, but I just couldn't help it. I wanted to see my resume. And when I looked back there, I saw them with the other children. And Lord, they all had on black shrouds. And the funniest little hats on their head. And the teachers were back there, and they had on them crazy things too. And after a while, a lady came over there and took a book and laid it up on the piano. I don't know why she laid it up there and opened it like she was going to read, but she didn't read. And she laid the book up there, and then she started to play. When she started to play, they started, and I looked back there, and the funniest kind of walk. Said they'd step, and then they'd stop, and they'd step again, and they'd stop, and it took them the longest time to get up there. I said, Lord, they'd be good people to send for the doctor for the devil, because he'd sure be dead when he got there. But I looked back, my regiment doing it too, just like them. And when they went up, all the teachers, they had on the fine robes. They went up on the pulpit. They didn't call it pulpit there, but they went up on the pulpit. And all the children marched up and they sat on the front seat. Well, when they called them, they went up and made their speeches. My Reggie spoke too. And they gave them the plumas. When they got the plumas, then they started out. That same funny walking again. And say, I just wondered, how come they come in there by themselves come in their mind to teach it. Then the teachers wouldn't go out with them. They say, well, now tell us, how come they call it mincemeat? Did you find that? I said, no, I don't know how come they call it mincemeat. And the various ones were talking, pretty soon the swamp angel said, well, I tell you now, I figured that thing out in my mind. The reason they call that the mincemeat was this. These children been in school all these years, they've just been getting ready. And today when they got up there, they just told them, I'm through with you now, and you supposed to mince to do something yourself. And you see, they brought them in, but when they got ready to go out, they didn't go out, they left them, said, now you're to commence right now. I think that's what that mince meant, man. I'm inclined to think Swamp Angel was right.
Wonderful story. Yes, Mark?
Well, what is your occupation now?
Well, I am now, I'm not retired. I left the Bankers Trust Company about 3 years ago because I wanted to devote my time to things that I wanted to do. And in the first place, I'm a lecturer for the Board of Lay Activities of the Methodist Church. And I do educational work. I teach in the educational department and head of the educational department at St. Mark's Methodist Church. That is a church at 137th Street and Edgecombe Avenue, and we have there about 4,600 members, and we have about 1,800 in our educational department, and I spend my time in that and in the lecture work, and then I'm still writing. I'm working on a book now. I'm just about to finish Half White, which has to do with the miscegenation in South Carolina in 1824. And of course, before this book, I did a book, Early Negro Church Life in New York, that took up the religious life of Negroes from the time they came to New York up to 1840. After that, I did that for the New York Library. After that, I did Touchstones of Methodism, which had to do with the Negro as a part of the Methodist Church, which has been integrated for a number of years. And after that, I did My Souvenirs, a book of poems from which this poem in here comes. And I do various writing for the publications of the Methodist Church. And then, in the summertime, Janice and I go up to the farm, and I don't do much riding there because she wants to go fishing, she wants to walk uphill, so we go fishing, and we go tramping across the hills, and she plays with the dogs, and my summer's just about thrown away.
Would you read that poem for our tape?
I'd be glad to.
Wonderful.
Now this is the nearest that I could come to this same woman whose son was going to school for his senior year. I've been sending you to college now for 6 or 7 years. Since the morning that you left me, I've been shedding bitter tears. But I thought of that old saying, sunshine comes behind the storm. So my young man, when you're finished, you just bring that college home. I've been shivering by the wash tub, I've been sweating in the field. Many times I had to borrow and I almost had to steal. But I held on to my patience, beat them soap suds into foam. All the time my heart doctor said he wanted to make that college home. Folks here say you want to be nothing. You're just fooling time away. But I shake my fist and tell them, wait until some future day. I got food enough for winter, plenty of clothes to keep me warm. So you trot on off to college. Then next June, you bring it home. Don't you mind these folks here talking, they ain't half as good as you. And they're bound to nag at good folks, that's all they know how to do. So next spring, when dogwoods blossom and the bees begin to swarm, I'll be waiting for to see you when you bring that college home. I don't mean bring home the buildings or erect them good folks' place. Bring home Christian education and that high-toned college grades. You just grab them fessers, habits, hold them tight through wind and storm. Then when you get your diploma, take them all and bring them home. Show these folks here that you've got them by the speechless that you make, by the specs that you'll be wearing and the way your coattails shake. But don't get above people. Settle down and don't you roam. Be a light in your own village. Be a college here at home.
How long can it take you to write down Swamp Angel?
Well, this book, you mean from the time that I actually started writing until I finished it?
Yeah.
3 years.
3 years.
I'll tell you something about that in writing. When it comes down to creative writing, sometimes you can get at it and go right through with it, almost without a pause. There are other times when you can do a bit and you just can't do anymore. And when you find you are failing, that is the time to stop. You can ruin your story by forcing yourself. Now, I have, in the book of poems, I have one poem there, Ultimatum. I heard that a friend had died. I was in college. And by the way, I was in college when I wrote this 19. And that has been by far the most popular poem that I've ever written. And what I was going to say about this poem, I heard of his death and went to bed and I couldn't sleep. I got up and took my pen, and I don't think I stopped writing. It was like writing a letter. When I wrote the entire poem, there was another poem I started and finished it 5 years later. And that was as quick as I could. Yes?
Janice told me once that your great-grandfather was Booker T. Washington.
No, no, no.
That's on my mother's side.
On her mother's side?
Oh, it's just curious. How old were you when you were born then?
I must have been about 10 years old. Oh, yes. I tell you, you see, in those days, we didn't have access to books such as you have now. And the libraries, we had no libraries for color in the city of Atlanta, even. And the libraries at school were crowded, so the children virtually had no books. I used to make great use of Grier's Almanac, the Woman's Birthday Almanac, and such books as that, such things as that. And when we went out into the country to spend the summer, in the evenings or on rainy days, those older people would enjoy sitting down telling those stories, and we would just sit there and listen and listen and listen. And I want to tell you this. I remember once my grandmother told me about, I guess the sun was about almost down, to go to the store and get some matches. Well, I went up to the store to get some matches, and two or three of the older men were around telling these stories, telling ghost stories. I should have gone home right then, but I didn't. And he saw me there, and he decided he'd get me home. He said, I heard a whippoorwill Say, hear that whippoorwill? I said, yes. Say, know what he's saying? I said, no. He said, just catch him and kill him. They holler something like that, but he said, just catch him and kill him. Well, I decided now it's time for me to go home. I got out and started home. It was dark, and I was frightened. So I got down the road. I felt that something was behind me. I looked back, and there was something. When I stopped, it stopped. And I could just see something white right here and something dark. I started to walk off. It walked off behind me. I said, this is it. And they said, you can't outrun one. I said to myself, but I think they're wrong. I kept walking, and it kept walking. I could just see the light at the house. I said, I can't stand it any further. I'll make a run for it. I started out to run. It started out to run. And here I go as hard as I could put my feet to the ground, and it was coming right after me. And I said, if I can just get to the door, if I can just get there. I got closer and closer, and just as I curved in the door, something ran by and said, bah, a pet cat has been following me.
On the after rail, he fired salute to the captain's boots in the teeth of the booming gale. The captain sat on the commodore's hat and dined in a royal way, off toasted pigs and pickles and figs and a gummery bread each day. The cook was such, and the cook was Dutch and behaved as such, for the diet he gave the crew was a number of tons of hot cross buns served up with sugar and glue. All merciful pride we laid aside, and we cast our vessel ashore on the gubbly isles where the poopful smiles and ruffled bundles roar. We sat on the edge of a sandy ledge and sat at the whistling bee, and swimming in bats wore waterproof hats as they danced by the sounding sea. On rugged bark from dawn till dark, we fed till we all had grown and commonly shrunk when a Chinese drunk came in from the Tarby zone. She was stubby and square, but we didn't much care, and so we cheerily put to sea. And we left the crew of the junk to chew the bark of a rug-up tree by Charles Edward Carroll. Next one I'll read is called The Twins. In form and feature, face and limb, I do so like my brother that folks got taking me for him and one for one another. It puzzled all our kith and kin, it reached a fearful pitch, for one of us was born a twin, yet not a soul nor witch. One day, to make the matters worse, before our names were fixed, as we were being washed by nurse, we got completely mixed. And thus, you see, by fate's decree, or rather nurse's whim, my brother John got christened me, and I got christened him. His fatal likeness even dogged my footsteps when at school, and I was always getting flogged for John turned out a stool. I put this question fruitlessly to everyone I knew. What would you do if you were me, and to prove that you were you? Our close resemblance turned the tide, my domestic life, for somehow my intended bride became my brother's wife. In fact, year after year, the same absurd mistake went on, and when I died, your brothers came and buried Brother John. By Henry S. Lay. The last one I'm going to read is called The Lobster and the Maid. He was a gentle lobster. The boats had just come in. He did not love the fishermen. He could not stand their din. And so he quietly stole off, as if it were no sin. She was a little maiden. He met her on the sand. And how do you do, the lobster said. Why don't you give your hand? Why she edged away from him, he could not understand. Excuse me, sir, the maiden said. Excuse me, if you please. And put her hand behind her back and doubled up her knees. Always thought that our lobsters were a little apt to squeeze. Your ignorance, the lobster said, is natural, I fear. Such scandal is a shame, he sobbed. It is not true, my dear. And with a pocket handkerchief, he wiped away a tear. So out she put her little hand, as though she feared him not. And suddenly...
couple of them during the course of this conference, men who are extremely capable and able. We talked to some others, and we finally decided that the man for this job was Hal Stebbins. Hal, in his own inimitable way, went to work on it fast and has given us what I think is a standout campaign. Here's the first one. The theme is the voice of authority. And after the last 3 days, if that doesn't ring true, nothing ever will. It rings true from the standpoint of what we have heard within our shop, the editors, the publisher, the assistant publisher, the circulation manager, and I hope maybe even the advertising director. And it certainly rings true from what the people on the outside have told us. The things we've heard about Printers, Inc. are summed up in that, the voice of authority. Will the page boys come up here and help distribute these? The one in skirts, I mean. I want you to see this one for yourself, close up. Are there enough of these to go around?
Every other plate.
There are?
Every other one.
Well, do it.
Alternate.
Every other one. Read the copy. It's a joy to read. Take a look at the illustration. Now, it would have been very nice if Hal could have come down the street and told us the story of how he put this together. It'd be an awful long street. Unless he had bagged a ride with the Conroes, I don't see how he could have done it. The best I can do, therefore, is to read parts of the first letter he sent us after he agreed to do the job and after he had gone through the incubation period. This was written January 24th, so you see this thing has been on the way for quite some time. About 4 days ago, four words popped into this crazy brain, the voice of authority. My Jimmy Valentine department told me I had what I'd been looking for, a promotion peg for PI. Consider. Publishers beef and bellow about lineage and revenue and statistics, which often boomerang in the hands of slide rule Sammy. Maps and mathematics were marshaled to show how we are first and everybody else thinks. In the midst of this welter and woe comes a message that lifts the reader up to the stratosphere, that takes him out of the humdrum hooey of how much per page per reader per thousand and does something to his heart and mind. It talks about a priceless ingredient no other book in the field has, something that cannot be bought but must be earned, something Mr. Advertiser makes his own the moment he buys a page of white space in printer's ink. His message, too, takes on the voice of authority. Sure, it's intangible. The big things in life are intangible. Can you properly essay love and faith? Can you reduce them to dollars and decimals? Hardly. Yet they motivate the world, or what is left of it. In one of my copy capsules, I say two reasons why the Bible is still book number one. Its text is timeless. It has the voice of authority. To me, for 35 years, Printer's Ink has been and still is the Bible of advertising and marketing, and for the same reasons. So why not lay down an emotional barrage around the voice of authority and let your men in the field move in with specific rifle fire? Let them bring out the sales statistics depending on the man, the mood, and the moment, while we lift the prospect up to a plane where he can't argue back because there's nothing he can argue about. We are not staking out a claim. We are making a bold, unimpeachable assertion. It has taken Printer's Ink 64 years to achieve and perfect the voice of authority, and what other publication in its field can say as much or half as much? In short, why talk against competitors when you can lift yourself above them? It isn't that you're aloof, you're alone. P.I. is P.I., and that's that.
I think a copy of that letter would be given to every one of you out
there. Let me finish. I don't mind telling you that I wrote the attached in about an hour.
That.
But I've been thinking about it a long, long time. Hal and I talked about it in the Plaza Hotel, I think, one afternoon in October. I have worked it up into a comprehensive because the visual impact is all important. And you can't get the whole flavor of a campaign from a sheet of copy. And then he goes on and talks about the details of what you see in front of you. Now let me show you some of the others. I have six campaigns, and of course when we get through here you can come up and take a look. I'll read the copy of ad number two. Under the main illustration, or at the side here, Confucius, stone rubbing from the collection of Rudolph Johnson. Here, from the Analects of Confucius, quote, without knowing the force of words, it is impossible to know men. The voice of authority. There is no special virtue in being old, but there is special virtue in the judgment and maturity, the skill and seasoning that come only with the years. Printer's Ink has won its spurs, its right to speak with authority, not through force of circumstance, but through force of ideology. The things it has stood for, the things it has fought for, the things that make for timeless truth in advertising. Across the misty span of 64 years, Printer's Ink has done more than report the news. It has taken you backstage in advertising and marketing, has given you the facts behind the facts, has helped you interpret the news so you could apply it to your problems here and now. Printer's Ink believes, no less than Confucius, that without knowing the force of words, it is impossible to know men. You cannot divorce human behavior from sales behavior. To know what makes campaigns click, you must know what makes humans tick. Thus, it is the special function of Printer's Ink to present both men and markets with the voice of authority. Title page from the Quran. Under here it says, from the collection of Muir Dawson. Next to the Bible, the Quran is acknowledged the most influential book in the world. Muslims memorize much or all of it, and Islam considers all science but a commentary on the Quran. It is easy to be pompous and pontifical, but that is not the PI pattern. There is nothing holier than thou about Printer's Ink. It speaks with authority only because it is rooted deep in the forces that have brought advertising and marketing to their present stature in America. For 70 years and more, it has been an integral part of those forces. It has not been content to be merely a reporter on the sidelines. Instead, it has been in the forefront of every crusade for better standards, better ethics, better management. The net result is that people who count in advertising and selling believe in Printers, Inc. and what appears in its pages. To them, Printers, Inc. is good gospel, not because it is self-righteous, but because it is self-effacing, because it is sound and sincere. They look to Printers, Inc. not only for authentic information, but mature guidance. It is the weekly magazine and their field that speaks to them and for them with the voice of authority. Socrates of Athens wrote nothing himself. His life and teachings have been recorded in certain of the dialogues of his disciple Plato and of Xenophon. Above, a typical excerpt from a Socratic dialogue. Strange as it seems, Socrates and Printers, Inc. have much in common. For instance, Socrates often referred to his teaching as midwifery. His mother, Phanerity, was a midwife. It was his business, he said, to bring ideas to birth. Printers, Inc., of course, is interested in the business of words, but it is far more interested in the transmission of ideas, for words bereft of ideas are words bereft of reason. Moreover, Socrates spent his time in the arcades, in the marketplace, in the gymnasiums, wherever men congregated, to find out what people thought and why. Printers, Inc. does not believe in swivel chair editing. So its task force, too, spends much time in the marketplace, finding out what advertising and marketing campaigns are clicking and why. Printers, Inc. not only dispenses news, it distills it. Printers, Inc. not only examines trends, it cross-examines them. Printers, Inc. not only counts words, it weighs them. Call it the Socratic method, call it anything you like. The end result is the same. When Printers, Inc. does speak, it speaks with the voice of authority. It takes authority to reach authority. The door to top brass is always open to top brass. Men who have achieved respect other men who have achieved. That's human nature. And magazines are no different than men. It is no idle truism to say Printers, Inc. gets your message across the threshold of big business, often when your own men can't gain admittance. The reason is simple and selfish. Printers, Inc. does something for the people who read it. And believe it or not, presidents, executive vice presidents, sales managers, and advertising managers are people. That's why Printers, Inc. does something for the advertisers who use it. It opens doors, ears, appropriations. It gives you the same priceless privilege to talk to America's top business audience with the voice of authority. Down here. The men who say yes to budgets, large or small, say yes to Printers, Inc. Not only is it taken seriously by top advertising men, but by top management. That's an important byproduct of Printers, Inc., B-U-Y product. And that's something you won't find out about Printers, Inc. when you look it up in standard rate and data. No salesman is too good for this platform. There are two ways of looking at a business publication. One is to view it as a magazine in which you place an advertisement, mainly because you think you should. The other is to view it as a great forum you are privileged to address, a platform on which to place the most eloquent salesman you have. Printers, Inc. provides such an advertising auditorium. Before you in this vast gathering are the key advertising and sales executives of the nation, flanked by the younger men and women on the way up, an alert audience of 23,000, whatever strong. It stands to reason that no salesman is too good for this platform. No idea is too big. No message is too dynamic. No copy is too good. No presentation is too forceful. The more power on the platform, the greater impact on your audience. For Printers, Inc. gives every advertiser in Printers, Inc. something no other publication in the field can offer, something it has taken 64 years to produce and perfect, the voice of authority. Over here.